welcome to Movie Geeks United and the Art of Cinematography series. After a highly successful run shooting commercials and music videos, Salvatore Totino was chosen by Oliver Stone to lens his gridiron epic, Any Given Sunday. As a first feature, the Mammoth Project tested Totino's powers of vision, endurance, and resilience, and he reached the finish line in stunning fashion, providing the film with a visual landscape that vividly realized its highly charged, intricate, and emotionally volatile subject matter. After his follow-up feature, the Roger Mitchell-directed Changing Lanes, starring Ben Affleck and Samuel L. Jackson, Totino began a fruitful and lasting collaboration with director Ron Howard, a relationship that has thus far spanned the course of six films, including The Missing, Cinderella Man, The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, Frost Nixon, and The Dilemma. Totino's next feature, Welcome to People, written and directed by Alex Kurtzman and starring Chris Pine and Michelle Pfeiffer, will be released sometime in 2012.
I grew up in Brooklyn, Italian immigrant parents came over from Italy, and grew up in a very working class home. And in my house, you either went to college or learned a trade. Mm-hmm. And when I went into high school, my grades weren't that good heading into high school. So my parents encouraged me to go to a trade vocational high school. I went to a school called William E. Grady in Brooklyn, where I learned how to be an electrician, residential, commercial electrician. But in high school, my grades started doing a lot better, and college counselor encouraged me to go to college, and my math skills were very good. Mm-hmm. So I went in the direction of electrical engineering with the New York Institute of Technology for about 2.5 years, and I was like, oh, my God, I can't do this. This is boring. So I dropped out of school, and I went to work for an electrical contractor. I was trying to figure out my life at that point. I was 20 years old, 21 years old. And, the idea of making a living through art was not something that was looked upon in my house, the household, because mm-hmm. my parents didn't understand it, really. So in trying to find myself, I decided to take the New York City policeman's exam. I was like, oh, maybe I want to be a cop, So I took the exam, and I scored extremely well. I got two questions wrong. But because I was white Caucasian, and affirmative action was very, very big in 1985, I was put on a secondary list. So I didn't make the first round at the police academy. And I say this, and I'm telling you this, because of this, it sent me in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, I was sort of upset about affirmative action because I was like, look, I scored really well on this test, and now I can't follow through. So instead of going in the police academy July of 85, I was due to go in like January 86. So that summer, I started looking at taking some photography classes. I was always interested in photography. And right before I was able to do that, a distant relative was at a family gathering one night. We started talking, and he worked for a commercial film company. He invited mm-hmm. me to come see him, and I came, visited him at work, and I was like, wow, this is really interesting. How can I get in this business? And he's like, well, you got to work as a PA, and you need to sort of quit your regular job and try to hustle up some PA work. So I went and I quit my job. My boss, the electrical contracting boss, thought I was nuts because I was doing really well. I didn't quite understand what I was going to do with myself. And my relative wound up getting me a job for a day and on a commercial. And he said, look, if you do well, I remember it too, it was Duncan Hines. And if you do well, you could work the next 2 days. So I came to work. I was like, well, what do I do? And he's like, look, you need to be conscientious. You need to arrive to work 5 minutes early, never 5 minutes late. Be focused and always willing to help everybody. So I was really eager. I was 21 years old.
Right.
And the end of the third day, the director was leaving the set, and he thanked me. And he said, thank you for your help. What's your name? And I said, my name's Salvatore Totino, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. And he left. And the producer came up to me. He's like, "Are you available next week?" I was like, "Available? What? Are you working? You know, we want to hire you next week." I was like, "Oh, yeah, okay, great." So I wound up working as a PA. And I never wound up taking the photography classes because I got right into the film business, and all of a sudden I was working a lot. And I bought myself a camera, and I taught myself how to print. There used to be a dock room on 20th Street off the Flatiron District where you could rent the dock rooms. It's called 2020. Mm-hmm. And I used to, you know, go in there and learn, print my own black and white photography. And slowly, I was working as a PA, and I met a camera assistant one day on a job. It was Paul Gaffney. And I was like, you know, I'm really interested in getting in camera. How does one go about it? And he said, "You're really interested?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I could use a little help today." I was like, "Great." He goes, "Can you move those cases?" We were shooting in the house, and told me to move them to the other room. And then they moved the camera in the other room, and they set up to do a shoot. And then he's like, "You know, can you move those cases over there?" And I moved the cases over there. And then later in the day, he's like, "Move the cases over there." And he's making me move the cases. And I'm saying to myself, "Oh, this guy's just doing this on purpose. Let me see where this goes." And at the end of the day, he says to me, he says, "You know, I see you're really serious. Why don't you, next week I'm prepping a camera, why don't you come to the camera rental house and I'll start showing you how to work a camera." So I went to, you know, went to the rental house, and he started teaching me camera, and I started tagging along on jobs with him for free. And I eventually started loading and seconding, and so that's how I got into the camera department. And I, you know, always had inspirations at that point of being a cinematographer. And it was late 80s in New York, and the whole music of the MTV was starting to really take off.
Right.
So I started working with a cinematographer by the name of Harris Savides. And Harris was originally a still photographer, and he made the switch over to cinematography. And I was going back and forth between New York and L.A. with him. And Harris would let me shoot second camera for him a lot. And one day we were working with this director named Peter Kerr. And Peter really liked having me around and shooting second camera. And we were doing a lot of work. And one day he called Harris up and said, "Hey, Harris, I'm doing this music video. I was thinking of Sal shooting second unit. What do you think?" And Harris was really encouraging him and encouraged him to go ahead. And I shot this little stuff. And when Peter saw the film, he said, "You know, if I would have known it would have been this good, I would have given you the job." He said, "You know, one day when something comes up, the right job for you, I'll hire you to shoot it." So these MTV, a couple of months later, these MTV promos came up. That was April 93. And I shot these MTV promos, and they took off. Everybody's like, Who shot these? It was Sal Tutino, Harris Savides' assistant. And, you know, I had an agent call me at that point and said, "Look, we want to represent you." And from there, I got here.
Well, and it, music videos in that period of time, I mean, they were very bold and experimental. I would think that that was an excellent training ground to take risks.
Yes, it was really an experimental training ground. They were art forms. They were really art films, and the directors had much more creative license than they ever had. You know, the band would say, "Hey, we're interested in working with you. Come up with an idea," and they would write some very interesting, crazy ideas, and then you had to come up with, you know, an interesting approach to them. That live video I shot for Lightning Crashes, which was the band's first video.
Right.
You know, the director, Jake Scott, had done a video with Katie Lang that year. I wasn't involved in the project. And he shot some double exposures, and he showed me the video, and he said, "You know, I'd really like to do something like this." So we came up with this approach about shooting all in-camera double exposures. There's no visual effects, no post-production at all in that video. Everything was done in camera. And a double exposure in camera is you shoot the scene, the film, then in the dark you roll the film back to the beginning and shoot it over again. So it's a double exposing the image. And, you know, there's a little bit of math and science involved in that, and a lot of creativity, and sometimes some wonderful mistakes come out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it was exciting. It was exciting to sort of be involved with that. And today, with the new digital technology, you can't do a double exposure. And
yeah.
The first thing somebody says when you have that idea, saying, hey, I want to shoot film and I want to do some double exposures, you're like, well, we're shooting digital. You know what? We'll do that in post. And it's not quite the same.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
It takes the creativity away from the cinematographer, away from the director, and other people get involved at that point. And somebody's like, well, I want it more transparent. No, I want it less transparent. Oh, this needs to be like this. Oh, this needs to be like that. So those wonderful little moments and nuances that just happen organically through film just isn't there.
Well, and you have all of these controls at your fingertips. I mean, you can apply these effects in seconds, but that doesn't necessarily facilitate the most creative solutions sometimes. Is that what you're saying?
It doesn't always create the most creative solution.
But have you embraced digital? I mean, have you been shooting digital as of late at all?
Oh, I haven't done a feature film digitally. However, I would say 90% of the commercial work I do now is digital.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I like it. I've embraced it. There's just some aspects of it that are not like film.
Right.
And you can't achieve certain things you could in camera like you could with film. Like varying the speed, for example.
Mm.
You know, like an old hand crank camera where... you know what hand crank cameras are, do you?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so, well, if the audience doesn't know, before there were electrical motors on cameras, there were hand cranks, and the cameraman had to turn this crank to turn run the film through the camera and expose the film. So by doing that, you never got an exact 24 frames a second, and so that's why old silent films really look like they're flickering a lot. So if you wanted to achieve that today digitally, you can't. But if you shot on film, you could do that with an old hand crank camera, or you could do it even with a modern film camera and get a vary motor and just kind of vary it like you would do a dimmer in your light switches in your home where you go up and down with it. There's little things like that. And that, I got to say, I miss that. I miss having that at your fingertips.
Well, somebody
later to finish that for you.
Exactly. It's interesting to me that, I mean, you definitely gained the technical knowledge you needed to kind of excel at your craft at that stage of your career. But when did you feel like you were gaining the storytelling chops? Because that's the other major component of what you do. I mean, you're a visual storyteller.
Well, I have always looked for the storytelling, and I did start out with commercials and music videos, and the videos were much more little storytelling than commercials were. Well, some commercials you're trying to tell a little quick little story in 30 seconds, but not so in an in-depth way.
Mm-hmm.
So my first feature film, you know, I always wanted to do features, and I got lucky enough to work with Oliver Stone on my first film, which was Any Given Sunday.
You had a heck of a first feature. I mean, that's a massive project.
You have no idea. It wasn't just the fact that it was a massive project. It was working with Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
And that I lost 22 pounds on that movie. And it was intense. Oliver said to me the first day of principal of photography, "Welcome to Vietnam." I was like, "What the hell are you talking about? What does he mean?" You know, and doing a feature film is like going to war. And also, in that situation, Vietnam was not coming back in a body bag. And I think Hollywood was looking at me coming home early from the film. And, you know, needless to say that didn't happen. You know, I look back on that experience, and there's a lot that I learned from that, and there's a lot I wish I could go back and change. I do like the way the film turned out. It did shy me away from doing feature films for a little while because I thought that sort of madness that took place I didn't want to be part of. So it took a little while for me to find another script that I liked and a director that I'd like to work with, get back into features. So I did Changing Lanes after Any Given Sunday, which the first original script is not, which isn't the same script that the movie was finished with. The opening was really ethereal and interesting, and it really drew me in. And I loved Roger Michel. I had a great great experience with him. And from that moment on, I was really, really more hooked on feature films than ever before.
Yeah. Well, I just want to go back just briefly to Any Given Sunday, because I spoke with Robert Richardson for this series too, who did amazing things with Stone, and he has his own war stories with with Oliver Stone. But what I wanted to ask about was there's one actor that I idolize above all others, and that's Al Pacino. So can you share any anecdotes or stories about shooting with him?
What was great about Al is Al's a really hard worker. He's really focused. He really believes the character and works at perfecting his character.
Mm-hmm.
What was really amazing to me was one of the first times, you know, the beginning of the film, I'm on set and, you know, facing the set, and Al walks on and he just, you know, taps me on my back, like a little slap on my back. He's like, "Hey, Sally boy, how you doing?" And my hand, God, Al Pacino called me Sally boy. I can't believe this is happening, you know?
I don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes to the biggest battle of our professional lives all comes down to today. Either we heal as a team, or we're going to crumble. Inch by inch, play by play, till we're finished. We're in hell right now, gentlemen. Believe me. And we can stay here, get the shit kicked out of us, or we can fight our way back into the light. We can climb out of hell. 1 inch at a time.
But, you know, Oliver, to be honest, Oliver was very tormenting on that movie. And a little out of his mind, which caused this sort of, you know, I always say Oliver's a method actor. He becomes what the film is, and you know that was, you know, football and that environment and those characters were a crazy environment, and that was Oliver. So we were filming one night, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Oliver wouldn't come out of his trailer. We had to do this scene in the rain where the camera sort of moves up into Al's face. And Al's assistant comes out and set and is like, "Sal, what's going on?" And I'm like, "Look, I don't know. I really don't know. Al, you know, let me see what I can do. Let me keep calling." So I get to the AD, and I'm like, "Look, Al's getting impatient. We got to, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. We got to get going here." So he kept calling Oliver. Oliver finally comes out of his trailer. It's after 3 o'clock. And, you know, Al comes over to me and he's like, "Sally, I'm no good after midnight." And, you know, in the scene, you know, the camera just pushes in on Al in the rain. It's all dripping down on his face. And he's disgusted because what had happened in the story, Jamie's teammates have given up on him. And
right.
That game that was shot in the rain, and he's just getting his ass whooped. And Al is disgusted by the whole thing and upset. And I think part of Al's performance came from the fact that Oliver tormented him by not getting out of his trailer and wearing him down. And in my mind, I'm like, "You don't need to wear that out. You just need to ask him, and he'll give it to you."
Yeah, of all people. Yeah.
But that was Oliver's method.
Well, you can feel that kind of aggression in the film.
Oh, yeah.
It benefits from it, I mean, I have to say.
There was a lot of crazy aggression on that movie that didn't happen on the camera, happened off camera.
Yeah. Well, that's a testosterone-filled set.
Tell me about it. And look, I grew up in a tough neighborhood. I grew up having to fight my way. And, you know, thank God, because it prepared me for that world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I've spoken to a lot of DPs in service of this series, I mean, they all kind of cherish the idea of a collaboration, like an ongoing career-long collaboration with a director, and you found it with Ron Howard. How do you guys connect? What is it about the two of you that make a good team?
It's a really honest relationship. And it's a collaborative environment. Ron is somebody who is a great guy. He's a great guy to work with. He's really smart, extremely focused, very prepared, does his homework, very eager to be at work. We drive into work together. There's many times we'll say, you know, we're picking you up at 7 o'clock, and we get there at 5 to 7. They usually pick me up first because of where we live in proximity to each other. And I'm always early. So we'll get there at 5 to 7, and Ron's outside pacing. And then he'll get in the car in the morning, and he'll like, morning, how you doing? Did you guys sleep? Yeah. Okay, so this is what I was thinking today, and he pulls out a shot list. And I'll look at the shot list, and I'm like, Ron, there's 35 shots on here. You know, and we got to shoot two scenes today. He goes, oh, yeah, here's a shot list for the second scene. You know, another 22 shots. And we achieve that in the day. And a lot of that is because Ron's really prepared. And the honesty is I could tell Ron how I feel about something, what I think. He'll be like, Sal, what do you think? How should we do this? How should we do that? And I'll be like, oh, we should do it like this. And he'll be like, okay. Or, no, I don't want to do it like that. And I'm like, okay. You know, we don't take anything to heart. And it's in that way because there is a give and take. And it's always for what Ron thinks is better for the film. And that's why it's been such a wonderful relationship. I cherish it. I really do.
And what strikes me about him as a filmmaker is how versatile he is. I mean, how different these movies are that you guys have done together, from The Missing and Cinderella Man and Da Vinci, Frost Nixon, Angels and Demons, Dilemma. I mean, they're completely different stories and environments, and so I mean that has to be a great thrill for you to be able to bring out that versatility in what you can do as well.
Well, it keeps me challenged.
Yeah,
you know, it's just not the same thing, and it's easy for one to become complacent and rely on what you know and how you know. If you're doing the same thing, it's kind of like making the same dish over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I make a certain pasta dish, and I make it the same way over and over again, and it tastes really good every time, but there's nothing different to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're working on the same subject matter, you tend to become complacent and do it the same way. And that's what's great, because Ron's a really good storyteller, and he's interested in finding different subject matters. And approaching them differently.
Yeah.
He's constantly elevating his game, which is elevating my game. You know, cinematographers usually get fired the first week of principal photography. Studio starts seeing what the film is, and they don't like what's going on, or the movie's going too slow, and you're way behind schedule, and you're the fall guy. And a lot of times, you are the fall to it. So the first week of The Missing, the first film I'm doing with Ron, it is going incredibly well, like unbelievably well. And the film's looking good, and we're ahead of schedule, and we're gaining a lot of extra shots, and it seems like Ron's happy. So it got very sunny outside, and we were at the ranch. And what we were doing at the ranch is we were trying to go outside when the weather wasn't, when it was more stormy and feeling that sort of coldness of the winter, and when it was sunny, we were trying to go inside and light inside. So we were setting up for a scene outside, and it got all of a sudden the skies broke, got very sunny, and we ran into the barn to go shoot the scene. So I'm lighting scene and there's a little setup time. And Ron says to me, "Hey, Sal, can I talk to you over here for a minute?" And it was about 15 feet away from where I was. And that 15 feet felt like an hour walk. And my stomach dropped. I was like, "Oh, my God, I'm getting fired. It's Friday, the end of the first week. He wants to talk to me." I'm in the back of my head, I'm like, "Oh, my, you know, how could this be? It's been such an incredible week. And, you know, does he expect more from me?" And he pulls me over and he says, "Sal, I got this script called Cinderella Man." And before he can even finish his sentence, I said, "I'll do it. I'll do it." He's like, no. "Just read it first and see if you like it." And I was, you know, I didn't tell him until after. I was like, "Look, I was just so grateful that you weren't firing me."
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Cinderella Man is actually a movie that I wanted to ask you about because, I mean, I would think the particular challenges of this would be capturing the not only the period, but the feeling of being in the ring. I mean, it's a very visceral sense you get from that movie. I mean, what were the challenges for you specific to that film?
Well, you know, Ron, you know, that was one of the things in pre-production. Ron's like, "How can we make this different than other boxing movies? What do you think?" And I was like, what really impresses me about the movie is what changed, what made Braddock want to do better on getting turning his life around. So I was more obsessed with his emotion, and the way to get into his emotion is to get into his head. And I thought it'd be really good for the viewer to become Braddock in the ring. And Ron's like, "Well, how are you going to do that?" And I was like, "Well, I'm just going to get in the ring with the camera." He's like, "Are you nuts?" And I was like, "No." And, you know, we did some tests. We figured out how to get in the ring with the boxers and the camera. And I operated the camera. It was in the ring. We figured out the choreography and, you know, move the camera around. And there were certain key moments that we would punch up where the camera would actually get hit. I put a camera inside this tire cam that we suspended off of bungees and covered with padding. And I had it on wheels that I can move it around and have, you know, either box or hit it. Or there was times I'd go with a smaller camera, I'd put on some padding, and I would get hit by the boxers. So that, I, you know, we're in that, you have that moment, that feeling, and I wanted it shot on 35mm. I did not want to use a different medium. You know, like in
right.
Ali, they took these lipstick cams, two of them, and put them together. And that was sort of the video aspect of it. And, I wanted it to sort of all stay the same.
Right.
And it was challenging, and Ron was really open to that. And, you know, he was concerned. It's like, "Look, as long as we don't hurt our actors, let's go for it."
The thing is, I can't afford to pay the heat. I've had to farm out my kids. You know, to keep cutting shifts down at the docks, you just don't get picked every day. I sold everything I got that anybody would buy. I went on public assistance. I signed on at the relief office. They gave me $19. I need another $18.38 so I can pay the bill and get the kids back. You know me well enough to know if I had anywhere else to go, I wouldn't be here. If you could help me through this time, I sure would be grateful.
Well, in general, what is your communication with the actors, because obviously their main conduit is the director, but what is your level of communication with them?
Well, you know, Ron creates a very comfortable environment, and, you know, it's about communication and communicating to the actors, and the actors, when they feel comfortable and secure that you're there to help them with their performance, is a collaborative environment there, and that's the way it was on. That's the way it's been on all the films that I've worked with Ron. Russell was you know, very into the idea of the camera in the ring. And he was like, how are you going to be able to do this? How are you going to be able to keep up with us? And I'm like, I'll keep up with you. You'll see. And when he saw that I could, he was even more encouraged to push it further. So, you know, that we all work together in elevating his performances in the ring.
Right. And then you have something like...
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I'm so sorry.
No, please. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to turn it over to Frost Nixon, because that's a very intimate performance piece. It's a stunning, stunning movie. But when you're working on something like that, I mean, this came from a real life event, obviously. I mean, is referencing the original source material an important part of that preparation for you?
Well, referencing the source material in the sense of just having the knowledge of what the interviews were like.
Mm-hmm.
The visual language of the film was more about what the period was and trying to capture that moment so that it didn't feel out of place.
Right.
And learning who those characters were, who the real people were and what they were going through to help tell that story visually.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my preparation in that film. What was very interesting was Frank Langella. I really didn't get to know Frank like I have any other actor on set until after the movie. And Frank insisted on being called Mr. President. And I'm like, okay, that's the actor's process. I respect that. And I'll call him Mr. President. Well, when Mr. President walked on set, Mr. President took the air out of the room. And it's interesting because it was Nixon walking on set. It wasn't Frank Langella walking on set. And that's just what's so amazing.
Yeah.
There was times we were shooting Frank, and the hair on my neck would just stand up, and I'd say, oh, my God, this is Nixon. I'm in the room with Nixon. And you really appreciate it. You're like, oh, my God, I'm really part of something here.
Yeah. What a phenomenal movie.
The team, the David Frost team, the actors were really close. Sam and Matthew and Oliver, they were always joking around and having fun. And so, you know, we'd be on set waiting for the president to come in, and you know, they'd be joking around, and some crew people would be laughing, and they're talking with everybody. And Frank would come in, and the silence would just, you could hear a pin drop.
Mm.
And he wouldn't come over and say anything. He'd just pace in the corner. And you're like, oh, my God, that's Nixon pacing in the corner. The guy's come back from the dead. and you know, and it shows. And, damn, I wish Frank would have won that Academy, because, you know, at this point in his life, it would have been nice for him to have that. So
you feel that in that movie, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you feel his immersion. I mean, he'd lived with that part for so long between stage and film. Oh, he's great in that.
He became the president. And I really didn't get to know Frank till after that movie. And, you know, we're friends, and it's just, it's really wonderful.
You're doing something here, which I am not doing, and I will not do, throughout these entire broadcasts. You're quoting me out of context, out of order, and I might add, I have participated in all these interviews without a single note in front of me.
Well, it is your life, Mr. President. Now, you've always maintained that you knew nothing about any of this until March 21st. But in February, your personal lawyer came to Washington to start the raising of $219,000 of hush money to be paid to the burglars. Now, do you seriously expect us to believe that you had no knowledge of that?
None. I believe the money was for humanitarian purposes, to help disadvantaged people with their defenses.
Well, it was being delivered on the tops of phone booths with aliases and at airports by people with gloves on. That's not normally the way lawyers' fees are delivered.
Look, I have made statements to this effect before. All that was Haldeman and Ehrlichman's business. I knew nothing. Okay, fine. Fine. You made a conclusion there. I stated my view. Now let's move on. Let's get
on. If Haldeman and Ehrlichman were the ones really responsible, when you subsequently found out about it, Why didn't you call the police and have them arrested? Isn't that just a cover-up of another kind of...
Well, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have just called the feds into my office and said, hey, there's the two men. Haul them down to the dock, fingerprint them, and then throw them in the can. I'm not made that way. These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I knew their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you got to do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation, and then... do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry.
And the last film you did with Mr. Howard is The Dilemma. And I hear from all kinds of people in the film business, whether it be the director, writer, composer, what have you, that like comedy takes a very specific skill. Did you find that to be the case?
You know, Ron was great about the approach in that, because he was very specific about, look, let's not make this look like a typical comedy.
Right.
Let's make it just flat lit. So he gave me some licensing, some license to be creative with the approach to it, and I think we did. It was definitely hard subject matter to work in, because sometimes you don't know what's funny or how something gets put together. So, you know, you're constantly wondering how it's going to turn out. And you hear about people like Judd, you know, directors like Judd Apatow and Adam Sandler, how they do a lot of takes. And, you know, they'll do 2-3 takes, and then the next 2-3 takes they do, they change the dialogue. And they change the dialogue, and they're constantly changing it, and it's in that comedy way, and they're looking and pushing and stretching it. So that was very new to me, because I hadn't experienced any of that before.
Mm. Did you, because Vince Vaughn is an actor that likes, I've heard, that likes to kind of explore and experiment, and you know, go off on to see what he can come up with. Did you try to find an element of improvisation yourself on that film, or was it a challenge?
No.
To yeah.
No, at that I would sometimes improv if I saw blocking and say, okay, let me change this. Let me change my idea here. Let me change my approach here, because in rehearsals, it's not what I thought it was going to be, or they changed it.
Right.
So, you know, it wasn't as spontaneous as you could be, because you needed to give the room to the actor.
Right.
And, you know, there's
right.
a couple of scenes, and, you know, this is, it's unfortunate, because there are a few scenes in the film that were longer, and they were really funny. But because editorial purposes, you had to cut them down. But there's this whole dialogue, and I still, and me and my crew sort of joke about it sometimes. No peep Tom. When he's outside the massage parlor looking in at his friend, and,
yes.
you know, the woman comes up and says, you peep Tom. He's like, no peep Tom. And it became this joke. And then he walks in, which, you know, was not in the film, but he goes into the massage parlor.
Mm.
And it gets really funny in this, because she's like, no peep Tom. He's like, no peep Tom. And, you know, so sometimes, like, in the middle of the day, when we're in the middle of, I wear a headset to communicate with my crew, and in the middle of a day where things are getting a little hard and tough and we're all working really hard, all of a sudden I'll just burst out and say, no peep Tom, and everybody goes, you've got to be there to experience it.
Yeah. So your new film, I believe it comes out this year.
Yes.
Welcome to People.
Very excited about it.
What can you tell me about that one?
Well, it's a personal story to the director, first-time director Alex Kurtzman, that he fictionalized. And Alex had, you know, because he had worked on this project for a really long time, he had very strong ideas and approaches to it. When I read the script, I immediately fell in love with it. It's a modern-day Italian neorealistic film, in a sense.
Mm.
You know, it's about humanity, it's about people, it's about tragedy, you know, it's about love and people changing. And so when I read the script, I was really excited, and Alex really kind of had another cameraman in mind, and I went to meet him. In the interview, I was so animated, and I had all these ideas and all these approaches because I really connected with the characters in the film, especially the main character, Chris Pine, and what he was struggling with and the certain moments, and I thought of how we could approach it. And so I kept expressing that and, you know, being Italian, talking with my hands and, you know, being all animated. And, you know, it went on for a little while, the interview, and then it ended and I left and I got in the car. And I was like, oh, my God, he probably thinks I'm on drugs. So hyper and excited. And almost by the time I got home, my agent called and said, look, they really want you to do the movie. I was so happy. I was really excited.
Wow.
So it was.
Did you had a?
Sorry.
You had a passion for it. I mean, that's.
I had a very deep passion for it, and I immediately connected with Alex and made a really good friend out of the experience.
Mm.
It was tough because it was a low budget film, for me. I mean,
right.
It was $18 million needed to be shot in 42 days, and Alex had very big cinematic ideas for the movie. So it was a challenge on. How are we going to achieve this? And I think we did. I don't want to give too much of the movie away. I'll just tell you that the actors were fantastic. You on set, and you kind of forgot sometimes you were on set. It's that kind of moment. It's a Frank Langella moment. There were two times in the film where Michelle Pfeiffer is fighting with her son, Chris Pine. And I, you know, as I said earlier, I operate a camera, and my camera was on Michelle, and I could just see and feel her emotion that I started to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really wonderful. And when you see this movie, you'll understand why.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
And Michelle Pfeiffer is... I'm so sorry. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer is just a stunning actress in every sense. I can't imagine.
She's a really stunning actress and an incredible person, too.
Mm.
Incredible to work with, very stunning, very flexible, just spectacular.
Mm. One more question.
The film out in the fall.
In the fall, it comes out fall of this year?
Well, I don't know when it's coming out. I'm just saying I hope that it comes out the fall of this year. Because I really think that the actors could get nominated. And Alex, for the first time directing, it was like working with a seasoned director.
Mm.
It was really like a seasoned director. He was like Ron in a sense. He did his homework. He was prepared. He's focused. He came to work enthusiastic every day. He never sacrificed. He never gave up. He never was complacent with any. You know, he just kept pushing it. And I love him for it.
I'm looking forward to it. Before I let you go, just one more question. I like to ask this one. Are there particular films that you refer back to for inspiration from a cinematography point of view?
You know, there are a few, and each case things are different. You know, there's one film that sticks out for me a lot called Ratcatcher, directed by Lynn Ramsey.
Yeah.
I really love the way that film was approached. A lot of Scorsese's films. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, he pushed it cinematically in a different direction. You know, the diving bell and the butterfly, and in the sense that, you know, they took this idea, you know, you get a script that says, okay, this guy's got a stroke and he's in a bed and he writes a book. And I'm like, oh shit, how am I going to make that interesting? And it reminds me that when you think, when you don't feel challenged, you're not challenging yourself.
Mm.
And it makes me look at everything differently. And that's what Janusz really, and Julian really challenged themselves on that film, and it shows. So, you know, I refer to that film in that sense.
Right.
Not every film that I look at is a direct visual idea, but more of an emotional feeling that it invokes. Or I'll draw from music. Big Tom Waits, Nick Cave fan. And, you know, Tom changed my life. You feel like you're a kid and being told the same old, your parents reading you the same book over every night. And every night they read that book to you, and in your mind, that book, the story looks different. And listening
right.
to Tom, Nick, the stories keep changing visually in my mind. So I draw a lot from music. I draw a lot from photography or a book that I might be reading. So the cinematography to me isn't just about technique, but it's about emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's some science involved, some math involved in it, and that, you know, you could approach it in a very technical way, but it's not technical. It's really an emotion, and it's
right.
like cooking. You know, it's about the ingredients that you put into it, how well the dish tastes, and you don't cook. At least I don't cook. I love cooking in a technical way. I cook emotionally. And I'll
yeah.
be like, oh, you know, this could use a little of this, and this could use a little of that. Ooh, yeah. And then, you know, I'll make a dish, and then the next time my wife will be like, you know, you make it like that again, and I'm feeling different that day, and I can never make it taste like I did that the first time, because I was feeling different. And
yeah.
That's the way I approach photography.
That's it for this episode of our Art of Cinematography series. You can listen in on additional episodes and interviews with many of today's top cinematographers, including Robert Richardson, Vilmos Zsigmond, Alan Davia, Paul Cameron, Jeff Cronenwith, and more, by visiting moviegeeksunited.net/art of cinematography.